Hello, I'm Jason Solomons. On Film Weekly this week, I meet actor Viggo Mortensen, currently winning praise for his performance in The Road. And from a big star to rising ones, this week I went down to BAFTA's London headquarters to find out about the Orange Rising Star nominees for 2010. I met up with Skins actor Nicholas Holt. Peter Bradshaw joins me to review the week's releases, including George Clooney in Up in the Air and Japanese family drama Still Walking. And documentary filmmaker Joe Berlinger is back on the big screen with Crude, the story of an Ecuadorian tribe's fight against the might of American oil giant Chevron. Yes, it's the Goliath of film shows. It's Film Weekly. Currently on release is The Road, director John Hilcutt's big screen adaptation of Cormac McCarthy's successful novel. The film boasts a huge central performance by Viggo Mortensen, who plays Man, a character in crisis in a post-apocalyptic society, desperately trying to save his son as they flee cannibals and head south in search of security and humanity. Let's hear Viggo in action in a scene with his son, played by newcomer Cody Smith McPhee, as father and son differ about the rights and wrongs of leaving a thief to die.
He's not gone.
What do you want me to do?
Just help him, Papa. Just help him. He's just hungry. He's gonna die.
He's gonna die anyway.
I'm so scared.
I'm scared. You understand? I'm scared. You're not the one who has to worry about everything. What? What'd you say?
Yes, I am!
Viggo Mortensen, what an absolute pleasure to welcome you back to Film Weekly. Last time I saw you was in this very room for good, so you're back for The Road, which is a movie that is basically, it's about you. I mean, you carry this movie on your shoulders. You're in almost every shot of this movie. It must have been quite hard work.
Well, it's two of us, really. It's Cody Smith McPhee, who plays my son. It's two characters. And I have to say that before we started shooting, yeah, I had the usual fear that an actor has. Well, now I've accepted this role, and yes, it's a great honor, but how am I going to live up to the demands of it, you know? And in this case, more so than any role I've had, just the emotional journey that I would have to go on, that would have to be somehow believable. But the other fear was that they wouldn't find a boy, because I'm so reliant on this boy for that emotional journey. That would really understand the story and be emotionally available. Yeah.
They say don't work with children, Viggo.
No, I love working with them and animals. I don't have a problem with that.
You Hidalgo, of course. You're very good with animals and children.
But I've never had a better partner, I have to say, of any age or experience than Cody. He's extraordinary, and I think when people see the movie, they will be very moved by what he does.
With a movie like this, it's very, the tone, it seems to me, is crucial, because you start so bleak, and in a way it continues bleak as well. You know, there's no musical number in the middle of it to kind of brighten that. As an actor, who do you work with? Do you discuss with the director how you're going to carry that tone? Because in a way the audience sees it through your eyes, so you're the indicator of tone in this.
It was really an internal journey, or research, whatever, you know. I couldn't rely on externals so much. Yes, I listened to certain kinds of music to get in the mood, as always, read certain things, watched certain movies, but in the end it had to come from inside.
What, can I ask what the influences were, what you were listening to, what the movies you watched to get in there?
I don't know. There were various things that I knew visually had something to do with, you know, certain Tarkovsky movies or certain performances, like there's an actress who only did one movie in 1928 called The Passion of Joan of Arc, Maria Falconetti.
The Dreyer film.
Yeah, and there's just, Carl Dreyer's movie. There's something pure about her emotional state. I don't know. But all those things basically fell away. It became, as it needed to be, about Cody and myself pulling these things out of each other, these feelings. And what moved me about the book and the script and the experience of shooting the movie was where we get to, the realization that we come to, why we want to stay alive, that there is always some hope in that we as human beings can, even when everything is taken from us, choose compassion over fear and loathing and contempt and mistrust. You know, you can choose kindness, basically. You can do, you know, the boy's character inspires the man to understand that it's better to act, to prevent misery rather than avenge it, for example. Those kinds of things are beautiful, and that's why the movie, like the book, in the end is strangely uplifting. You know, you have to go through this very difficult journey that you hope is credible and all that emotionally in order to get come to that realization that life actually is beautiful and that it is worth it's more important to value what you do have, no matter how little it is.
Can you talk about the filming of it as well? Because, I mean, I think the production design is extraordinary, but I gather that the world itself was rather, unfortunately, the backdrop to it. You didn't need to do too much sometimes. Where did you shoot? What was it like shooting in those areas?
Well, we were lucky as actors because that helped us get to that state. I mean, it really was cold. It really was wet. It really was snowing and raining. In other words, it wasn't in some studio and then they'd put it in post-production, as they can do.
Where were you?
We were shooting in the dead of winter in western Pennsylvania mostly, in the woods and in the mountains and, you know, places where there had been, you know, industrial pollution, devastation, you know, old mining areas. We also shot a little bit in New Orleans and neighborhoods that still look just like they did after Hurricane Katrina.
It must have been terribly depressing to go into the fact that the parts of the world look like Cormac McCarthy's description of them in the road.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you'd have to be blind. I mean, people say, do you think the world will get to this point? Does this movie serve as a warning? I suppose it could serve as a warning, but it's not really what it's about. And I think, furthermore, you'd have to be blind not to realize that many people in this country and everywhere in the world are already living lives approaching the desperation of these characters, are living just to survive from one moment to another, and struggling with the bitterness and anger that that engenders, and that many places in the world, you know, all you have to do is take an airplane trip over any country in the world, and you can see the effect of industrial damage and pollution. Yeah. You know, it's we're there already. In many ways, it's not so much science fiction.
I was looking forward to meeting you. You depress me now.
No, but it's. I think you walk out of this movie, maybe because you've been honest as characters and the depiction of the world that we're talking about. Leading up to it, when you get to the end, there is something quite beautiful about valuing the most important, the simplest things that we have, you know, that we have each other.
It was, I'm a recent father as well, so to me, this film, I think, 7 months ago wouldn't have meant as much as it means now. I mean, it really is a father and son journey, a father and son movie. You have children yourself?
Yeah, I have a son. And my son, at the age of the boy in the story, you know, he was somewhat like him. He could entertain himself. He's always been thoughtful of other kids, younger kids, which is not always the case with kids. I related. It was certainly a way in.
Viggo Mortensen, congratulations on your performance at The Road. It is a monumental one as well, and very nice to meet you after all, over the apocalyptic doom.
Thank you, we did well there. Good luck with your child.
Thank you very much, Viggo. I shall say hi to him for you.
Okay.
And The Road is on UK-wide release at the moment. And now, it's time to take off in search of a rising star. I've come to BAFTA today in Piccadilly for the Orange Rising Star nominees. I've been on the jury of this award this year, so there was kind of frantic discussion as to who should be on the list this year. So I'm really delighted that when the list has finally been revealed that it is a really good mix of young talent. We've got Jesse Eisenberg, who was in Adventureland and Zombieland this year. Nicholas Holt, who was in Skins, of course, on Channel 4, and is really good in the Tom Ford film opposite Colin Firth, A Single Man. Carey Mulligan, who's brilliant in An Education, of course. And then one I'm proudest of all is Taha Rahim, the young French star of Jacques Audiard's Un Prophète. A foreign language film getting a rising star into this list is quite an achievement, especially when you put him alongside Kristen Stewart, who is, of course, huge from her successes in Twilight and New Moon. So there are the five nominees for the Orange Rising Star. We're lucky enough to have two people who represent the Orange Rising Star, because Noel Clarke, who won it last year, of course, star of Kidulthood and director of Adulthood, and Nicholas Holt, one of the nominees.
The Orange Rising Star Award are Jesse Eisenberg.
I'm with last year's winner, the current champion of the Orange Rising Star, Noel Clarke, and this year's nominee, Nicholas Holt. Congratulations, Nicholas.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's big shoes to fill, definitely. Yeah, I remember watching Noel accept his award last year and thinking, that's cool, like, because we worked together a long time ago on Kidulthood. And it's fantastic to be following in his footsteps.
Yeah, they're good footsteps. They're nicely white-trained footsteps today. What did it do for you, winning the Rising Star?
I think, it's always going to be difficult as an actor. You know, some roles you get and some roles you don't. But I think what it did for me is enable me to be up for films that, you know, previously I wouldn't even been considered for.
And you've got now that this kind of godfather role, because you've kind of ushered Nicholas along, because it was it Kidulthood? It was a long time ago, and then you've kind of overseen his rise.
I nearly said a curse word there. I love Nicholas. I mean, you know, Nicholas obviously. The most important thing for me seeing Nicholas here today is Nicholas obviously did, you know, the film that we all know About a Boy years ago. And I think people were always like, oh, yeah, that kid from this, that kid from that. And then, of course, I think there was a period where he changed from that young boy into the strappingly good-looking man he is. You know, and I think one of the first films that really showed him in that six-foot, you know, light was Kidulthood, you know, and really kind of made people go, oh, actually, wow. And then, you know, he went on to Skins. And his career just flourished from there, and I think well deservedly. And no longer, people no longer say, what's important is people no longer say that kid from About a Boy, and that proves that he's a talented actor that's just gone from strength to strength in his career. And I'm proud of him. I know him, I know his family, I'm proud of him. I support him. You know, he was in Kidulthood. Sisters in Adulthood. I loved him.
This is a podcast, so we can't see him blush, but I can tell you he is blushing.
No, he knows, man.
And what's nice is that you say it was about a boy, but it's definitely about a man now, Nicholas. And
is that your headline?
That's good, isn't it?
That's a good one. I think that might have been used before. Someone's
going to
grab that.
It was me. But tell us about A Single Man, because it is, I mean, it's a brilliant performance from Colin Firth, obviously. Yeah. But you get into work opposite, you do an American accent, you wear the fluffiest jumper I have ever seen.
The thing that people haven't particularly liked about it so far. I've got quite a few emails from people who have seen it and said, the jumper, dude, you should have got rid of that. But, you know, at times in the film I do get rid of it and then I'm Starkus, so it doesn't really get much better, I suppose. I only got offered the role a week before they started shooting on that, which was insane, flying out there and working on the accent and everything and trying to get it all together. And now to be here... And the film to be doing so well feels very odd.
And working for Tom Ford, did you know who Tom Ford was? You're very sharply dressed now.
Now he's hooked me up, yeah. But I flew out to LA and went for dinner with him, and I sat down and I said to him, I said, so how have you got into directing? What made you want to make this film and stuff? And he explained quite humbly about his fashion past, and I was like, all right. So I went and Googled him afterwards and realised, quite the empire he'd set up at Gucci and his own brand now and stuff, and was kind of... thought I was a bit of an idiot, but I didn't have the, you know, a lot of people had the preconception before the film was, you know, it's a fashion designer's film and it'll be all style and no substance, and I didn't have that beforehand, so I went into it with an open mind and saw him as a director, not a fashion designer, which was useful.
Yeah, I think he's done a fantastic job. What about your co-nominees as well, because we can't forget them. I mean, what a group of people. Yeah. Such a wide group. Jesse Eisenberg, Kristen Stewart from New Moon and Twilight, mass ranks of those fans, and Taha Rahim from A Prophet.
Which I haven't seen yet. It's not out till the end of the month, is it?
No, exactly. And I mean, you know, it is such a wide kind of, you know, and of course Kerry Mulligan. Do you know each other? Is there a little kind of rising star kind of salon where you all sit?
I haven't met any of those guys before, actually, oddly. But, you know, it's fantastic that, as you said, the widespread of people they've got and the different diverse talents and the different kind of films that everyone's done and the levels they are in their career, you know, it's kind of madness. I feel a bit of a fraud being included in it, to be honest.
Imagine how I felt last year.
No, but you've got a different talent where you do the writing and directing and everything. So it's kind of this whole complete package, and you're making films where a lot of people, you know, aren't able to get those films made,
yeah,
and aren't telling those stories. So that's a big step. Whereas I'm just an actor.
What can we look forward to in the next year from you? You've got a film that you've written and directed coming out, haven't you?
I've got a few films coming out. I've got Huge, Ben Miller's Huge, where I played the lead with Tandy Newton and Johnny Harris is in that film. I have Neil Marshall's Centurion, which I'm one of the seven soldiers, you know, with Fassbender and Dominic West and stuff. And I have one of my films, 4321. Which obviously I direct and have written and I'm in as well.
And Nicholas, obviously single man that we mentioned. What else can we look forward to?
February, and then Clash of the Titans comes out at the end of March, which was an interesting process, and I learned a lot of that. And then I'm going away to do something, but I'm not allowed to say what it is. It's kind of top secret at the moment.
Really? Is it exciting?
It's very exciting, yeah, with some good actors, and it could be fun.
Is it in Hollywood?
It's not going to be filmed there, no.
What do you wear in Clash of the Titans? Is it tunic? I know you're young. You like getting the flesh out there.
Well, I've realised I only work with fake tan now. In a single man and in Clash of the Titans, that's kind of the rule. As long as I'm tanned, like, people seem to cast me. But it's a skirt and a sword and long hair extensions. So it's very, very odd. My own nan didn't recognise me when she saw the trailer. I'm there very briefly, but still.
Right, I
paused it. Yeah. I was like, nan. I'm in the trailer more than the film, to be honest.
Well, you've certainly got an orange glow today. See what I've done there.
That was good too.
Thank you. Congratulations on being an Orange Rising Star nominee. Noel, lovely to see you as well. Yeah, congratulations on a good year as the reigning champion. You're gonna have to give it up, though. You're gonna have to relinquish that title.
I know, and I'd be more than happy to give it up to any of these guys, especially Nicholas.
Thanks, guys. Nice to see you.
Cheers, nice one.
Cheers.
So, if you want to vote for the dashing Nicholas Holt or any of the nominees, just go to BAFTA.org, where you'll find all you need to do that. You can do it online or by texting. I'm delighted to say that I'm joined this week for the Hallowed Review section by the equally hallowed Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw. Welcome.
Hello. Oh, thank you very much.
Welcome back to the film podcast. Always lovely to have you, Peter. Thank you.
Lovely to be here.
Ah, excellent. Settle down, because we're going to review this week Up in the Air with George Clooney, Still Walking by one of my favourite Japanese directors, Koreeda, and we'll be looking at 44-inch Chess, starring a host of British gangster villain type faces. But let's look at Up in the Air first. It has 6 Golden Globe nominations for this coming weekend. It stars George Clooney as a man obsessed by his loyalty card while he goes around the nation firing people. He's got a new assistant played by Anna Kendrick, and she asks him why he's so obsessed with his air miles.
I don't spend a nickel if I can help it, unless it somehow profits my mileage account.
So what are you saving up for? Hawaii? South of France?
It's not like that. The miles are the goal.
That's it? You're saving just to save.
Let's just say that I have a number in mind and I haven't hit it yet.
That's a little abstract. What's the target?
I'd rather not.
Is it a secret target?
It's 10 million miles.
Isn't 10 million just a number?
Pi's just a number.
Well, we all need a hop. No, I don't mean to belittle your collection. I get it. It sounds cool.
I'd be the 7th person to do it. More people have walked on the moon.
Peter, Up in the Air, directed by Jason Reitman of Juno fame.
Yes, I was slightly embarrassed at myself how much I enjoyed this film, really. I suspected that it is very much influenced by the work of the great master Alexander Payne, and particularly his great disillusioned road movie about Schmidt. It's like that, but a kind of light version.
He's not quite Alexander
Payne,
is he?
No, it's not as dark, but it's very well done. It's very amusing. It's very well written. It's smart. It's exactly right for George Clooney. I mean, it's not too heavy and serious. George Clooney doesn't try to be funny particularly. He's not trying to do big gags.
He doesn't wear the moustache and do the big eyebrows thing.
The big funny takes that he sometimes is very rashly persuaded to do. He's kind of smart and stylish and all those things that we kind of love him for. And it's a nice film. It's very distinctive and unusual. And it is about kind of corporate America and how everything is identified and how people, without admitting it to themselves and without knowing it, really thrill almost sensually to kind of brand recognition and how they love the idea of logos and brands. Yeah.
And it's about loyalty.
Yes.
To something that is not loyal back to you.
Yes. It's about loyalty which makes no demands, a loyalty which only accumulates in the favours bank in a way and doesn't demand a kind of reciprocal weight against these payments, as it were. You can amass more and more and more miles and have more and more plastic and phony smiles directed at you from various phony corporate employees, and there is something kind of narcotic, even kind of erotic about it.
Well, he certainly is sort of, you know, yes. there's a scene with him and Vera Farmiga where they finger each other's kind of graphite membership cards.
And it is erotic, and there is something kind of funny and satirical about the movie. So I was sort of embarrassed at myself because it isn't a very deep film, and it's not very astringent in its commentary, and yet it's elegant. And very well done.
And enjoyable. Up in the Air by Jason Reitman. I thought the direction was a bit missing on this one. I didn't hate it, but if people are kind of tipping it for an Oscar win, I wasn't so sure.
That's a little bit much for me. But I did enjoy it.
Over to Japan now for Still Walking by director Hirokazu Koreeda, or Koreeda Hirokazu. This is the story of two grown-up children going to visit their family, their parents by the sea on one summer's day. Peter, familiar Japanese classic tropes here, familiar from, I suppose, Ozu's Tokyo Story, to which I'm sure this is an homage, a nod,
and
a fitting one.
Koreeda isn't a very Ozu-like director, although he handles this material as if he was born to it. But his succeeding film, for example, is called Air Doll, and it's about somebody who falls in love with an inflatable sex doll.
Yeah, which I thought was great.
Yeah, it's completely different. I mean, this director has not suddenly matured into a kind of Ozu Jr. figure by any means. But this is his, I think, one-off, single-issue homage to the great man. And as it happens, it comes out in this country at the same time as a very big retrospective at the BFI South Bank Centre in London. So it's a very nice context for it. And there are lots of things in the film which sport with, which invert and transpose elements of Tokyo Story.
Because Tokyo Story is about the parents, the elderly parents go to the towns to visit their children and find themselves kind of...
They are the fish out of water. They're the lonely ones kind of meandering about and finding that nobody has got time for them except, heartrendingly, the widow of their son who's been killed in the Second World War. Now that is kind of shuffled like a pack of cards. These elements have been shuffled around and turned on their heads. And now the elderly parents are at home. They are, the father is a much more pungent and formidable patriarchal figure than the father from
a retired
Tokyo
doctor,
Story.
Isn't he?
He's a retired doctor who has been for decades nursing a sense of anger, rage, and disappointment with his children, of which he has no vocabulary to express.
And this is because they have a grief running through the
family.
They
have a grief running through the family that the eldest son has, when he was a boy, saved a schoolmate from drowning and died in the process. And through a terrible irony, the boy that he saves has turned out to be a chump, a fatso, and a loser. And through a weird mixture of sadism and masochism and a strained desire to prove that nothing is wrong, they insist on inviting this poor, grinning, sweating loser to tea every year at the same time as their children come as well, just to put themselves through the sheer crucifixion, forcing themselves to relive it and to go into denial about it at the same time.
Well, it seemed to be very much about, we see it as this kind of almost kind of powerful, painful ritual, but it seemed very Japanese of it. There's lots of, I'm going to give you this for your shrine, and they kind of, these observances, and we seem to be joining just at that moment when that observance is about to break, the kind of, the pain of all those years of observance.
You hear it kind of creaking and snapping like the timbers of an old galleon, you think, oh my God, any second now, and in fact, it doesn't really. And this is why I think that there's something misleading about people saying, oh, it's very Japanese and how can we possibly understand it? I've never thought that watching this film or any of Ozu's films. I thought that could be made in Surrey. That could be made in Essex. I understand, of course not. Families not saying anything to each other. You know, it could be about my family.
Well, absolutely. That's what I mean. Like, this has got all of my favourite things about world cinema, I was going to say, but modern cinema, really. Yeah. I mean, it's just, there's no special effects. I think there's one, there's a sort of butterfly that kind of floats around rather beautifully.
Yeah.
But it's got food, it's got families, it's got laughter, it's got crying. It's just got that moment of drama that is just
And ineffable. I think it is universally accessible because we think, well, families, we have this kind of Hollywoodized thing that they have to break out every 20 minutes in little narrative-controlled crises and rows and people kind of getting off with each other in the upstairs bedroom and being overheard in the baby monitor and all those things that we expect in this Hollywoodized version of reality. Yeah, it's good, isn't it? If I'm pitching it. But in fact, you and I know that that's not what happens. It's much closer to the allegedly alien and distant and exotic Japanese, in inverted commas, world of Still Walking, where these things are heartrendingly obvious, and yet you spend all your emotional energy swallowing back your rage-filled
the
arias.
The power of the unsaid, I think, is Still Walking. I loved it, I have to say.
I liked it very much.
I know it's only January, but this is one of my favourite films of the
year.
I
liked it very much indeed.
Back to London now, Peter, for a gangster drama, 44-inch chest. Now, before Peter Capaldi came on the scene in The Loop and, I suppose, the thick of it, the kings of swearing in British cinema were Louis Mellis and David Sinto, the writers of Sexy Beast. They're back with their first script since. It's called 44-inch chest, directed by Malcolm Venville, and like Sexy Beast, it has Ian McShane and Ray Winston in it. Ray Winston is suffering from a bit of a shock to his manhood.
Liz, love, what's wrong?
I'm so sorry.
What are you sorry for? What are you sorry for, Liz?
I'm sorry, Colin.
So you said that. I've got that. What are you sorry for, Liz? You're scaring me, Liz.
I've met someone else.
What?
That's Joanne Whalley. Remember her? There she is, telling Ray that she's no longer with him. Mm. A bit of a shock, as we say, which gives us the start of 44, which kind of, like Sexy Beast, which started to Peaches by the Stranglers, has Ray supine on the floor to Harry Nilsson's Can't Live Living Is Without You.
Yeah, that's a wonderful opening. It's a brilliant opening. I would go so far, however, as to say it's the only really good thing in the film. The movie doesn't go anywhere. It looks like a stage play. It's set. The idea is that all his dodgy mates assemble supportively in what looks like some wrecked kind of East London club, apparently just to urge on him to beat the crap out of his wife's lover.
There is who they have captured,
and
he sits in the cupboard in the corner,
rather Tarantino-esque way.
I think
this is disclosed. Well, I don't want to start spoiling it, but
because not much happens, you
because don't not much happens because really there isn't much plot to spoil, and that is what's so exasperating. It looks like a draft of a. I suspect they had it in mind as a stage play. They must have done. I further suspect. I wonder if this isn't something that predates Sexy Beast, and they've got out of the desk.
And really, out of the 44-inch chest. Out of the drawers.
The 44-inch chest of drawers. I wonder. I may be totally wrong. Certainly, they are both terrific writers. And there's some of the great stuff in it. Ian McShane as the gay gangster, absolutely hilarious.
There's a wonderful kind of Sexy Beast moment where he sort of tells the story of a night out he's had with Stephen Burkoff. And that really is cinematic.
Suddenly it shunts back in time and you think, wow, this is great. Now we're talking. We've gone somewhere else apart from this sort of boring stage set. We've gone something else. Is something going to be revealed? Has something happened? Is Ian McShane's relationship with the rest of them going to look different after this flashback? And the answer is really no, unfortunately. It's not. You could kind of take any 5 minutes of it, sit down and watch it and enjoy it, because there would be a lot of snap, crackle and pop happening in the script. But frankly, I was very disappointed. And I mean, clearly, as I understand it, the two writers and Ray Winston and Ian McShane are all four of them the executive producers. They obviously thought, look, we had such a great time with Sexy Beast. We did so well out of it. Surely we can sit down and create something else. And I think they still can, but 44-inch chest isn't it.
Peter Bradshaw, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
You can, of course, read all of Peter's reviews by picking up a copy of The Guardian itself on Friday, or you can go to the web, www.guardian.co.uk/film.
Men, women and children of the Kofan people, I come from England, and I, on behalf of my country and my foundation and my husband, I greet you all most humbly.
That was movie producer and spouse of Sting there, Trudy Styler, making a heartfelt appearance in Joe Berlinger's documentary, Crude. a film which deftly follows the struggle of a small Amazonian tribe in Ecuador as they challenge the international might of Chevron to take responsibility for the pollution caused by their drilling from the early 50s to the late 1970s. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by Joe Berlinger on the line from New York right now. Joe, congratulations on Crude, which it seemed to me an incredibly detailed and complicated story told with great clarity and great skill. So my hat off to you for kind of finding a way through the narrative of this amazing tale.
Thanks so much for having me, and you know, thanks for the compliments. It was a hard film to make. I think the biggest challenge I've been up against on a number of levels, but the film seems to be working, which is good.
Yeah, because I mean, in a way, you have to wade through, if I may use a metaphor that is in the film, a jungle of issues and a jungle of kind of almost a you know an oil slick of kind of obfuscation to get there and to get your story. But eventually, yeah. You boil it down to this David and Goliath kind of battle, which it is, which I suppose is kind of one of the great kind of dramatic impulses of fiction and cinema itself.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, you know. I think it works as a piece of cinema because Pablo Fajardo's story, the lead attorney in the case, is just, you couldn't script something like that. You know, impoverished oil field worker pulls himself up by the bootstraps, sees the injustice and the pollution all around him and decides to do something about it, gets a law degree under the most improbable of circumstances, finds himself as the lead attorney as his very first legal case against the fifth largest company in the world. I mean, so that kind of blueprint for a dramatic structure, I think, makes it work as a piece of cinema, but it's also, a very important social issue documentary.
Well, it has eco credentials, it has green credentials, it has these dramatic credentials. It's almost like a sports movie is the way you describe it there, you know, the kind of the no-luck hero kind of rising to the top. How did you come across the story, Joe? When did you first get on there? Because it looks like you were there from the beginning, but you can't have been, I'm sure.
Strangely enough, you know, even though it had this incredible dramatic arc that I just explained, I kind of got dragged kicking and screaming into the film. It wasn't obvious that there was a film to be made when I first was told about the story. Basically, the American lawyer Steven Donziger in the movie, who is their consulting attorney, came to my office in Manhattan, told me about the case, told me that they were into year 13 of this long struggle, and a lot of red flags as a filmmaker went off in my head. First of all. You know, I'm a cinema verite documentary maker, which means I like to film stories in the present tense without the use of narration, so the events have to kind of tell themselves. And I was worried that, you know, I had missed 13 years of the struggle. How am I going to tell the story?
So what was the clincher?
Stephen was very persuasive.
Yeah, he looks like that kind of guy.
Yeah, as you see in the film, he's a very persuasive guy. And I was very upfront with him that I had my doubts, but if he still wanted to take me down to the Amazon, as he said he did, to see the devastation, I would be happy to go. He was very convinced that if I actually went down there, I would have a change of heart, and he was absolutely right. When I got down there and I saw these bubbling oil pits dotting the landscape, when I saw the impact on the indigenous people, I was embarrassed to be an American, you know, if it were true that an American company had anything to do with this, legal or not, you know, because at that point I hadn't dealt with the issues, but I saw this, you know, this once pristine part of the world just completely devastated by oil production. And I think the thing that really pushed me over the edge was on day two of my initial scouting mission, we went by canoe to one of the ancestral villages of the Kofan people, and I got out of the canoe on my way to have a meeting with the village elders to hear about the impacts on their way of life. And I just happened to notice out of my peripheral vision a group of community people sitting by the river preparing a group meal, and I noticed that they were using giant vats of canned tuna fish to prepare the meal, not freshly caught fish. And when I inquired, I found out there were no fresh fish to catch anymore. And so here are these, you know, very once proud, self-sustaining people, these water-based people who have lived off the water for millennia, you know, are being forced to eat canned tuna fish, and they have diseases they never had any, you know, 40 years ago. I just, I just felt like a moral duty to tell the story.
Yeah, there's some of the most haunting images of your film are the skin diseases that are affecting some of the kids. The dead chickens I found a rather kind of haunting image as well, which is obviously a correlative of the, because they peck at this kind of contaminated soil, and they're throwing these dead chickens away. Their livelihoods are being thrown away. That was a nice indicator.
Yeah, I mean, throwing away livestock when these people, you know, live on a couple of dollars a day.
It's quite an old-fashioned documentary in the way, and I mean that in the best kind of way, because it tells a very human story, and you pick your way through it. The editing must have been sort of a fascinating process for you to kind of say, well, what is the story here? Because what I really like about it is that it's very balanced as well in its old-fashionedness. It's not just, the poor indigenous people. You actually kind of give the politics of the thing and the corporation, you give them quite a bit of their shot about it as well, and you do cast doubt on the shifting moral sands of both of the sides of the argument.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you say that. I mean, interestingly, there's a whole new crop of documentary makers who, and I'm not being critical of them, but there's a whole style of documentary making where you kind of, you have a thesis statement. It's very clear what your thesis statement is. You bang it repeatedly over the audience's head, and there's no room for the gray areas. And life and situations are much more complex than a simple black and white. There's no disguising where my sympathies lay. Clearly, the sympathies of the film lay with the indigenous people who have been, screwed over by their government first and by the oil industry second. But the lawsuit itself has some very complicating factors, and I just think stylistically, you've got to give the adversary, quote-unquote, their say in a film.
Thank you very much for your brilliant documentary, if I may say, of Crew. Joe Berlinger, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Take care. Bye-bye.
Crude has a limited release here in the UK, but you can find out more by going to their website, crudethemovie.com. That is all for this week. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday for my Trailer Trash column. I've also got an interview with Taha Rahim from the Jacques Audiard film Un Prophète in there as part of the BAFTA Orange Rising Stars. The music featured in this week's podcast is from the very good soundtrack to 44 Inch Chest, composed by Angelo Badalamenti, best known, of course, for his work with David Lynch, scoring many of his films, including Blue Velvet and, of course, brilliantly, A Straight Story. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, incidentally, I am now tweeting, so at Jason Critic, there you go, and Film Weekly's producer, Jason Phipps, at JasoTweet. It's till next week. Goodbye.